this last session today is choice in action. And we might look at some of the critical evidence that started to surface on school choice, and our panelists will give us some idea of how school choice is actually working. We have five panelists today. Very pleased to have them all with us. First, I'm going to introduce them in order they will speak. Mrs. Bert Holt is director of the Cleveland Scholarship and Tutoring Program for the state of Ohio. She was formerly director of University Business and Cultural Partnerships with the Cleveland Public Schools. And she was also on the advisory board for the National Education Partners Program. We also have with us Ann Haynes, who agreed very graciously to join us at the last minute. Mr. Danielson had to bow out at the last minute. Ann is the designer, founder, and director of the Aurora Academy in Toledo, which is a charter school for children at risk for school failure, which was just started in 1998. So we're very interested in hearing from Ann and what she has and her experience with the Aurora Academy. Also on our panel is John Witte, who received his BA degree from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 1968. And following 3 years as a naval intelligence officer, he attended graduate school at Yale University, where he received his master's in philosophy in 1974 and a PhD in political science in 1978. In 1990, he was named as the state evaluator of the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. A study of that program through December 1995 was funded by the Spencer Foundation, and a book entitled The Market Approach to Education, An Analysis of America's First Voucher Program was published in the fall by Princeton University Press. On his way from the airport is our fourth panelist, Brother Bob Smith from the Mesmer High School. He's president of Mesmer High School in Milwaukee. So Brother Bob will be joining us imminently. Brother Bob has been a member of the Order of the Friars of Minor Capuchin since 1979. He is a native of Chicago, and he's currently stationed in Milwaukee at St. Conrad's Friary. In 1979, Brother Bob received a Bachelor of Science degree in Criminal Justice from Wayne State University in Detroit, and a Bachelor of Science degree in Sociology and Economics at the University of Wisconsin-Oshkosh in 1982. Brother Bob has a Master's of Arts degree in Administrative Leadership and Supervision from the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, which he earned in 1987. And he has done graduate level study at Harvard University, Catholic University, Marquette, Seattle, same amount of ventures. And so we're very interested in hearing from Bob. As all of you may know, his school in Milwaukee has done wonderful things. We're interested in hearing from him. Our last panelist of the day, and probably most appropriate so, is Dr. Myron Lieberman. By any means, Dr. Lieberman is considered perhaps the nation's leading expert on teacher unions. He's the author of 15 books on education policy, including Public Education and Autopsy, which was published by Harvard University Press in 1993. Beyond Public Education, published in 1986. The Privatization of an Educational Choice, published in 1989. He was educated at the University of Minnesota and the University of Illinois, and has taught at the University of Pennsylvania, Ohio University, the University of Southern California, and the City University of New York. He has served as a consultant to six state legislative bodies and several national organizations on questions of collective bargaining, as an expert witness, and as a chief negotiator or consultant in collective bargaining in numerous school districts. And since 1993, he's been a senior research scholar at the Social Philosophy and Policy Center at Bowling Green State University. His most recent books are The Teacher Unions and Teachers Evaluating Teachers, Peer Review, and Unionism. So I'd like to start off by giving the podium to Mrs. Holt.
Thank you, Ann. Good afternoon. It was on March 1995 that Governor George Voinovich, now Senator Voinovich, signed a two-year budget package creating a $5 million pilot voucher program for the city of Cleveland. It started out as a program or a pilot idea that was going to be for the entire state of Ohio, but it was the wonderful Ms. Fannie Lewis, who you heard this morning, who went in when it was determined that the Ohio General Assembly would not pass it for all of the state. and fought for to become the pilot of Cleveland. I also want you to know that it was a vision also of a Mr. David Brennan. Unlike Jennifer, the gentleman who is providing the many scholarships for your children, had the vision to make it happen in the city of Cleveland, and eventually, I'm sure, the state of Ohio, and the Ohio Roundtable that has been very supportive of this overall effort. But with that signature, we have the start of the program. In 1996, September, the Cleveland Voucher Program got started with about 1,500 students. But it was determined that we had more vouchers available because the tuition is so much less in the private schools in the city of Cleveland than what was thought. So we could add additional 500 students, bringing it to 2,000 students. It must be noted here that the school systems contiguous to Cleveland, that would be your suburban schools, could have opted to participate in the program had they so chosen to do so. They did not choose to do so. So in fact, the opportunity for public education to get involved in this choice experience was passed up. Indeed, it was an opportunity. In January 1996, the American Federation of Teachers filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of the Cleveland School Choice Plan and asked for an injunction. Now keep in mind now, we have the applications in hand. We are all ready to go. We're getting up to office. Everything is open. Everybody's expectations are up. And on July 31st, what happened was Franklin County Common Pleas Judge Lisa Sadler ruled that the legislatively approved Cleveland plan did not violate Ohio's Constitution nor the United States Constitution. Hallelujah. We were going to be in business. The Cleveland Scholarship and Tutoring Program has cooperated fully with any requests for any documentation needed to maintain these legal, judicial kinds of occurrences that are happening. So through two appeal courts, all the way to the Ohio Supreme Court, we have been able to maintain the momentum. Even as the program is being considered on appeal, our office continues to work with parents and the schools to get the students enrolled and maintained in a very effective and successful kind of educational experience. The program has been managed so properly that lawyers, without any difficulty, has been able to take it through to appeal. The Institute of Justice, Mr. Flint Bullock, who was just sitting in that chair, and Mr. Jeffrey Sutton, who was forming with the Ohio General, with Betty Montgomery's group, was very instrumental in pleading these cases. If our Constitution is a problem, it is one created by yesterday's citizens, which today's citizens can amend. As Thomas Jefferson indicated, each generation should determine its own destiny and not be ruled by the dead hand of the past. When the Cleveland Scholarship Program took effect, school year 1996-97, I call it the first class, we had over 6,000 applications, parents applying. We did award the vouchers with a wonderful kind of coming together of 1,000 parents on January 22nd in Cleveland without any snow and plenty of sun. Can you believe how good God had just shined his light upon us? And here we walk into this convocation center in Cleveland and thousands of parents, most appreciative, are taking their seats. And then you have the principals who, when I talked with them, said, I don't know if we want to get burdened with all this bureaucracy that we might be saddled with. The ODE might tell us that we have to adhere to their rules, regulations, policies, and all kinds of reports and take us away from what we're supposed to be doing. So we were able to convince them that they would indeed be able to maintain their autonomy. And so I have a sister who can vouch for that. She says amen. Now, the governor expanded the voucher program's budget, and they added the fourth grade in 1997, and that brought the number of students up to 3,000. That year, 57 private schools participated in the voucher program, and during the 1998-99 school year, this school year, there are 59 schools, so we have indeed added schools. That tells you that schools are quite satisfied. They're not dropping out. They're, in fact, coming on board. And there are 3,744 students participating in the program. Now, the major transportation problem that we experienced earlier has been ameliorated. That was caused by the unwillingness of Cleveland Public Schools, and without a direct order from the ODE superintendent saying, you must transport those students. It is by law that you transport students. regardless of where they're attending school. So when the order was finally issued on January 20, 1998, in less than 30 days, when that should have been done in 1996, majority of the children were assigned to buses, realizing a $1 million savings in transportation. In addition, an amendment to the Cleveland voucher legislation by Representative Mike Wise requiring that Cleveland School District provide transportation to students was passed in May 1998. This significantly decreased the number of students taking taxis to Choice School. So, during 1998 of this year, there are 3,744 students enrolled, 1,853 on yellow bus, while only 95 on taxis. Now, participating scholarship parents' average income is about from $6,000 to $10,000. Very, very poor economically. Spiritually, very, very rich. And what they want for their children? High expectations and great hope. They have take charge attitudes and assume responsibility when given the school choice opportunity. These attitudes and responsibilities are supported by our office. We provide newsletters, counseling for school admission process, as well as other school related concerns. Advice concerning transportation, school transfer adjustments between schools, telephone calls, mailings, etc. We're very, very active and very, very involved, not only with our parents, but with our schools and with our community. During a short period of time, we've successfully developed and executed the Cleveland Scholarship and Tutoring Program. With any new venture, it requires an inordinate amount of time and superb skill to put in place an organization and immediately execute the entity. This included securing commitment of the stakeholders. I did go to the president of the NAACP. The NAACP said they would not support us. In fact, they acted against it. But using that good old, let's come together, said, let Burke have her pilot. And so we proceeded without any demonstrations. Also, there is a person that really comes up against me, one of my representatives I work with, C.J. Prentice. We met on the street, and I said, listen, let's don't tear each other up against a program that we know will benefit all children. Let's respect each other. So what I'm saying is you have to quiet the individuals. You don't change their minds. The psychologist told me in desegregation when I was working that for the Cleveland schools, said you just can make people act right. So we felt very good about making people act right. We secured the stakeholders. We determined our workable policies and guidelines. We did our agreements. We developed our management program. We developed a management system, information system. If you want any information from us, just call us. We can pop a button and get you what you need. We have also a tutoring program. We have, in addition, created a lottery format based on 12 different categories. We orient those parents to the process. We involve them in the process. We instituted enrollment and admissions process. And we've established all kinds of support for transporting and working with Cleveland Public Schools in terms of their tutoring and getting that involved. We also work with the legislative branch, the judicial branch, as well as the executive offices and ODE. So I'm saying that in order to do this, you have to work with anybody and everybody to make it happen. It is accepted fact that peak performance and high efficiency has been realized as we evolve from the initial to the present. The maximum voucher is $2,500, less than 10%. You know about that. The average school tuition is $1,700. My goodness. Less than half. A third of what the Cleveland Public Schools is getting. We must understand that we have not taken money from the Cleveland Public Schools. The money remains in the district. In fact, the governor wanted to hold the school system harmless, and therefore money coming from the Disadvantaged People Adjustment Fund was increased. It was not decreased. Transportation costs were paid for. The district did not lose money. In fact, when it was coming out of our budget, they could have made money. They weren't so smart. In spite of dire poverty, our parents make the necessary sacrifices to make all of their financial obligations. Yes, they pay the 10% of the tuition, but they also must buy uniforms, and they have to buy the candy, and also they have to go to bingo and do some of that work, and they have to also maybe go in and help with the children at lunch. What is that doing? It's getting the parents into the school not to eat tea and crumpets and be talked to and talked down to, but to really be immersed in what's happening in education for their children. Now, an evaluation done by Harvard's program, Dr. Peterson, whom I have supreme respect for, he's determined that, number one, parents of scholarship recipients who previously attended public schools were much more satisfied with every aspect of their choice school than applicants who did not receive a scholarship but attended public school instead. Two, test score results in mathematics and reading show large gains for Cleveland scholarship and tutoring students attending two schools, the Hope Schools, in response to the creation of the Cleveland Scholarship Program. Three, choice schools did well at retaining students in the program. Four, when applicants remaining in public schools were asked why they did not participate in Cleveland Scholarship and Tutoring Program, most frequently mentioned problems with transportation and financial factors. Some of them, if they got free vouchers, just could not afford to pay the 10%. As well as admission to the desired school. Don't forget, choice gave them 3, 4, 5, some of them went to their fifth choice because of seating capacity, and sometimes opted for public schools if it meant they could go to a magnet school. It was very important to them that they apply to enhance the quality of their academic life in terms of their children. The report concluded then that we should in fact continue to mount this program. An informal student outcome survey completed by the school principals and teachers indicated that 97% of the students had good to excellent attendance. Academically, 52% of the students attained grade level, and 23% were above grade level, and 6% were substantially above grade level. Now, we're not talking about suburban kids. We're talking about students in an urban setting. In terms of fact, I've told you we had 17,480 applications through the program this year. The majority of the funds are associated with the scholarship and tutoring program. There's not any bureaucracy. Being an old, beat-up administrator, I said we wouldn't have a whole bunch of folk running around doing not anything, moving the chairs around on the Titanic. So there are only three of us administering the program. Once the controlling board gave money based for the transportation needs and the overrun in the evaluation, we returned $1 million to the state of Ohio. I want you to know that the parent guardians attribute exceptional attendance performance to not having to change schools. That's one thing that is not noted. When you're in a private school, you don't have to move, and parents in the inner city run from the landlord. And they might move 3 and 4 times in a given year. But if you're in a private school, that child gets into that school and can stay there 8 years. Now, what does that mean? Consistency and stability in the life of that child. You can't help but have excellent academic outcomes. Parents like the immediate feedback. Oh my, sister calls if the child acts up. They don't wait 6 weeks and everything's down the tube and the damage is done. Immediately, mother, father, whomever, grandmother, and there are a lot of extended families must get to that school and take action. Again, we have the tutorial grants which we are providing for the Cleveland school children. Very interesting. Cleveland did not want to take on politically. They would rather not have the scholarship program provide tutoring grants, thinking that it would drain their children. Not so. It did not. It does not. And finally, with the new superintendent online, she's saying, thy will, because they're going to put it with the evaluation of the principal. If you're not doing that tutoring program, what are you doing later? So, the tutorial program is geared to assist parents with the proficiency. We're pleased with that. The Cleveland Scholarship Program is unique. We think it's emancipating. It gives parents responsibility. They're taking it very seriously. They're making choices. Poor children in urban school districts across this nation finally have the attention they deserve, not necessarily out of compassion, but because of their inability to compete effectively in the world. To that end, schools throughout America, in terms of the urban as well as the suburban population, continue to put our kids and our nation at risk. Why? Because even we are last in physics in this world, and whether you're suburban or urban. Keep that in mind. So we're saying that choice is going to raise the level of education for all schools. If the school doesn't work, close the damn thing down. Now, on the adult level, we have things happening for children as well as their parents. I went into a home yesterday, Mrs. Broussard. Look for Time magazine this week or next week. She's going to be in there. Single mother, she's adopted two children, and she has two biological children. She's at Case Western Reserve. She has a nice home. When the children walked in the door, they went to the table, sat down, and started on their homework. Now, I know as a mother, an old beat-up mother, an old beat-up educator and administrator, you just don't let kids do it. That's when they let you know that they don't do it. Went to that table, did their homework, got up, came in and had conversations. I'm just thrilled. Another mother couldn't read. The children are teaching her to read. She's a Cleveland Public School product. We're talking about children. who have been on Ritalin, ADD, or whatever they call it. You know what it is, attention deficit disorder. And we're finding out when they get into the schools and they haven't had the records, suddenly these children are doing wonderfully. They were not categorized. They were not put into a box to remain there. They are very much engaged and very much involved. We're talking about attitude. We're talking about a parent that said, we all could do better when we were where we want to be, doing what we want to do. And for students with teachers who care. With the public forum survey out of Wisconsin, that's one of the second most important things. First, academic achievement. Secondly, that the parent wants teachers who care. And dogs and children know who's sincere. Check it out. Now, General Colin Powell, 2 years ago, said, I'm very intrigued and very interested in and supportive of school vouchers as a way of getting better education for youngsters. When interviewed at NAA Today and asked if he supported vouchers for private education, he replied, quote, I support using vouchers and seeing where it takes us. The parental choice goal will be achieved throughout the United States with all 50 states, District of Columbia included. All parents are free to choose where their child attends school without financial penalty. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Holt. I'd like to now introduce Ann Haynes.
Well, that's hard to me. That's the first chance I've had to sit down all day. First thing I want to ask is, how many of you are familiar with charter schools or have ever visited a charter school? Great. For those of you who aren't real familiar, I want to go over charter schools in Ohio a little bit and then focus in on Aurora particularly. Charter schools in Ohio were authorized June 30th of 1997 under House Bill 215. And when they passed the bill, they authorized a pilot project in Lucas County where an unlimited number of conversion schools and 20 startup schools, and these are brand new schools, could be started. They also authorized startup schools and conversion schools in the Big Eight school districts. Those are the only areas in Ohio right now that can have charter schools. Now, in Lucas County, with the pilot project, we were very blessed because they set aside money for startup costs. And these were grants, $50,000 for planning, $3,000 once you had your doors open, your first students in, to carry you through while they got all the financial stuff straightened out. That was a great help. We also were able to go through the Lucas County Educational Service Center as our direct sponsors. In the other large school districts, they are going through the State Department of Education as their sponsor. Aurora was the first school to open August 17th of 1998. We were followed very shortly thereafter by the Village Chalet, Model, Meadows Choice, and Jade's Academy. Those are the five schools right now in Toledo that are open. There are, I believe, 12 or 13 more that are proposed to open for next year. There are, I believe now it's 8 other schools around the state that are open, with close to 15 proposed. Most of the schools, as a matter of fact, all the schools that I've talked to in Ohio have waiting lists. As fast as we can get classrooms open, we're filling them with students. At this point, it's still early. There's not a lot of conclusive evidence yet, there's not a lot of quantitative data yet, but as the next couple of years go by, that's one of the things that we're particularly looking at in Aurora. Our children take the proficiency tests. We have to comply with all of the standard health and safety regulations. But charter schools are exempted from some of the state bureaucracy. We don't have to deal with the state purchasing system. We can choose our curriculum based on the way we design our school. Basically, like you said, with the bachelor program, we've been able to eliminate a lot of bureaucratic cost and that saves us money, which is good because we only get the basic aid allotment from the state with the federal dollars. We do not receive the property tax money locally. So we get by on about 4,500 per student. With Aurora particularly, just to give you some demographics, we are up to 124, 125 students. We started with about 45 the first day in three classrooms. We now have six classrooms. And we have part of a building. We're expanding into that building as it becomes available. We're looking to open six more classrooms this coming year. We have co-teaching, so there are two teachers in the classroom with the students. We're using multi-age classes. We have two early primary classes that have children from ages 5 to 9. We have a late primary that has children from 7 to 11. We have a bridge class that's 9, 10, and 11-year-olds. We have a combined junior and senior class that's 11 to 17-year-olds. With a lot of the children that come to charter schools, especially in Ohio, you'll find these are children who are not doing well in the public schools. Our particular school focuses on children at risk of school failure. Unlike 60 Minutes, a child at risk does not mean that they're severe behavior handicapped. What it means is that this is a child who has previously failed subject areas, has previously been retained, has a disability, is low income, single parent home, a racial or ethnic minority. So with that, we wind up with about one third of our students that are special ed, with 80% of our children who are low income, 64% are on free lunch, 16% are on reduced price lunch. About 40% of our students live in single parent homes, 40% are African American, about 40% Caucasian, the remainder are Native American, Asian, and Hispanic. We have probably 50 to 60% of the children that come to us, if they were not already in a special ed program, were receiving Title I services. So these are kids that are coming with a lot of needs. And when you come into one of our classrooms, it's one of the nice things with charter schools. I've talked about multi-age classrooms. There have been attempts around the state to have multi-age classrooms. There is one public school in Ohio I know of that does use multi-age classrooms. There are several private schools. But when you start talking about a multi-age classroom, then you have to get it past the bureaucracy, you have to get it past the union, and it's not happening. Even though when you look at both quantitative and qualitative research, this is what works for kids. When you look at, with two teachers in a classroom, we do a lot of individualization. We do a lot of small group work. Again, techniques that work for kids. And there are so many things that go on in our school that are different. The teachers help to run the school. There's teacher representation on the board. There are parents on our board. There are staff members on our board. So that the very people who have the most at stake, the people who have children there, the people who work there, are the ones who are making our decisions for us, saying, where are we going? And we're talking about empirical evidence. I brought a little bit here. This is from one of our classes. This is the late primary, was just in there observing today. And we use a program called Accelerated Reader. If some of you are familiar with that, it uses trade literature. And we use the STAR reading assessment. These children, and in the classrooms, we don't tell them, okay, we don't say, okay, this child's a second grader, this child's a third grader. They're just in that particular classroom. They're in Ms. Worley and Ms. Weiss's classroom. But when you use the STAR assessment, they do ask you to put in, okay, what grade level would this child be in? And so we have a second grader, we have third graders, we have fourth graders, and a fifth grader in that room working together. To give you an example, the fifth grader, he's been with us since August. when he took the STAR reading assessment in January, he tested at an instructional reading level of second grade. He was a grade behind, so he was only, if he had gone to Toledo Public, he was going to be placed in fourth grade. March 23rd, just this past week, he took the STAR reading assessment again, and he now has a sixth grade instructional reading level. The fourth graders, we're looking at children who were being placed age-wise, they should be in fourth grade. Coming to us, they were coming from placements where they would have been in second and third grade. And we're looking at, again, January to March, a child who gained a month, a child who's gained a full year in instructional reading level. There's quite a lot of growth. Third graders, again, children that are going from pre-primer level to third grade reading level in 3 months. Because the children are reading, the children are writing. You have to see it. When you have a school where parents choose to be there and kids choose to be there, there's a dynamic that occurs. These children, well, the one that I talked about, the one that should be would have been in fourth, but should be in fifth. When he came in August, he didn't want to come to school. He didn't like school. He was frustrated. He felt like he was stupid. And this child, his name is Pat Szymanski. We got the news last week. Has received the award for the Arbor Day Poetry Contest with the City of Toledo. And this child didn't believe he could learn. I have a child in our junior class who is 12 years old. And his parents brought him to us in October. They were in tears because they were having to call the police 3 and 4 times a week to physically get this child out of bed, dress him, and take him to school. He was seeing a psychiatrist for a school phobia. This child, last month, one of the other children that rides with him said, you know, we're being picked up because a lot of our parents carpool. It's the middle of the day. And she said to him, look, you have to go get your little sister and get ready because my mom's only coming once. I'm sick. I'm going home. She's going to pick you guys up too, so you have to go home too. This was at lunchtime. And this child looked at her and said, I don't want to go home. I want to stay in school. His parents haven't had to call the police on him since he started. One time, they've had, the first week he started, once, they had to physically take him out of bed and bring him to school. That's it. This kid is up in the morning getting them up because he wants to be there and he wants to learn. We have a child who came to us, fifth grade. She has a learning disability, and she had been told from the time she was diagnosed with a learning disability, she couldn't write. She came to us, and she couldn't. No one had made her write. No one had told her she could write. What they told her is, you can't do this. You have to have a scribe. And even with a scribe, initially, it would take us an hour to get a 4 or 5 word sentence written down in her journal. This child is now writing on her own without a scribe and is asking to write 2 and 3 page stories. That that's what choice can do. That's what charter schools can do. Personally, I have only one regret about charter schools. That is that when this law was passed, they authorized an unlimited number of conversion schools in the state of Ohio. That means that any public school, whether it be a school building or a school district, can, by the vote of the majority of its people, choose to become a charter school. They can take control. They can take control of their discipline. They can take control of their curriculum. They can take control of their finances. And they can do all those things that they stand out there and say, oh, if we could only do this, we could do so much for the kids. And that opportunity is there. It's been there since June 30th of 1997. And as of this date, there is not a single public school in the state of Ohio that has applied to convert. That's my regret. Because there are a lot of dedicated people out there, and this is their opportunity to see the same kind of things happen that are happening in our school every day. Thank you.
Now I call Professor Woody.
I'm going to try to save a little time here. I try to stick to the time of the king because we like to have some time left over. I even have a little stopwatch being quantoid like I am. You'll know. Now, I also want to apologize in advance for something else. I have to leave right at 6:05. I have a cab to get back on that very expensive airplane. In fact, I agree that plane was so expensive that I think the next time you do this, we should actually get that rich guy who runs Gulfstream. We can rent one of those Gulfstream jets and fly around to pick everybody up, and it'll probably be cheaper than doing it the way we did. Usually, it's not bad that I have to run out because by the time I'm finished speaking, I'm usually sort of shunned like an Amish deserter anyway. So I don't think that would be a problem. I have been keeping track, again, as a quantitative person here, of the speakers. There is some balance. There are 28 speakers, and I will be the fifth who's not totally in favor of vouchers. And I think that'll hold for the last two speakers who I know quite well. They will be in favor. I was the evaluator of the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program for 5 years, a very controversial program, very controversial set of evaluations, at least at the end. What I want to do is what I got up over there, if you can see it, I don't want to go through it. It's just simply what the voucher program is. And, oh, everybody will go to sleep at this time. Oh, it's I've done this before, too. If you can see it, it just gives you the different. It's a targeted voucher program when it begins, and then it expands. And the Cleveland program is on the far right side as a comparison. That tells you who are eligible, low-income kids primarily. When I studied the program, it was non-religious schools. It was only sectarian schools, non-sectarian schools. Okay, that changed in 1995 with a major shift in the law to include religious schools in the program that led to the court case that we were talking about in the last session. Also, the number of kids eligible has gone up, and the voucher has gone up considerably. It started out in 1990 at 2,465, and it's up, actually this year, it's just under $5,000. It's $49.50. So it's going towards $6,000 quite quickly. That's because it's tied to the state aid portion in Milwaukee, and the state aid is going up. What I'd like to do is just very quickly, I have a paper down here that just came out a couple months ago, which is sort of a real good summary, I think, of what I'm going to say, but with a lot of some fancy statistics, but also some not so fancy statistics. So you can just pick those up when you want to afterward. Don't do it now, you'll get lost in there. It's not something to talk from, believe me. Let me just say two things. Who participated in this program and what were the results, and then sort of what do I conclude from that? Who participated, I'm very confident about the statistics on this, and I don't think they're really challenged by anyone. The pattern was consistent over 5 years of surveys with different cohorts, which is important. So you got different people coming into the program each time, and they all look very much the same. Poor minority is the summary. 93% non-white, 75% single parents, $12,000 was the average income of the family household income, 60% on AFDC. Okay, and that was very consistent between the 5 years, but that was the averages over the 5 years. But there was also something else, and something that Bert said, that can be interpreted a little differently. The parents were also more educated than the average MPS parent. We had a large control group in the Milwaukee public school system. They also placed more importance in education, higher expectations for their children, and they had higher parental involvement in their prior public schools in Milwaukee, in the public schools in Milwaukee. Now, what that suggests is a very interesting thing. Number one is a targeted program can be created that fits the target, okay? In other words, that keeps it to the poor kids. There's no question the kids that we assume need help. Also, by the way, the kids were not doing as well in the public schools. They were either, with several indicators, but on test scores, prior test scores, they were either at the average of the low-income kids in Milwaukee or below, not higher. So they weren't doing well. No creaming here was taking place in the best students. But on the other hand, you've also got families that have interesting characteristics. It tells you something, first of all poor families aren't at all alike. Okay? There is a wide range in both poor and rich families in terms of things that they do, but there's a wide range within the poor community. So this image of sort of this ghettoized image that Mike was talking about before is just, you know, just silly. It's just wrong. Many of these parents were very interested in education for their children. They had been educated themselves. They understood the importance. They were willing to sacrifice. They put education above other sorts of things. Okay, more than the people who stayed in the Milwaukee public school system. Now, is that good or bad? Well, that's certainly good for the private schools because you get parents that are really going to work. But the question is then, are you creaming off the family, not the kid who's doing well here, but the parent that's going to be the motivator behind the kid? That's a real issue. That creates a policy problem. It also creates what's known as selection bias in statistical analysis, which creates havoc in terms of getting the achievement results later. So that's the picture. Now, one of the results, and again, I'm doing this within your time frame as I can, let me just do a positive and negative. Now, I didn't put them positive and negative, and the one thing I would like is to be, rather than reading about what I've written, which many people do, and often from detractors, please read what I wrote. It's up on the internet. It's the, actually, the words are there. They were carefully couched in the most bureaucratically neutral language I could find. I neutered myself to write these reports. And then it was blown out of proportion. But the book that's coming out isn't so neutered. It now includes the politics of all this, which I've never been able to write on before, so that's a little bit stronger. Anyway, let's put it in plus and negative terms. The plus side, the people who advocate vouchers love this and they never question it. The opponents of vouchers, the positive things, they either forgot it or attacked it. The negative things were attacked by the advocates and either forgotten or, I mean, and glorified by them. By the opponents of vouchers. And this literally happened. I got a file of sort of Albert Shanker picking and choosing, and then sort of voucher, pro-voucher people picking and choosing these results. And some of them I'll tell you what, I can talk about the questions later, about the ones that are questionable. Positive things that took place. Parental satisfaction clearly improved, both in sense of their satisfaction with the private schools over the public schools, and widespread satisfaction with the program. Okay, 99%, even if they were withdrawing the kids from the program, said the program should go on. Parental involvement increased even higher than it was in the public schools, and it was higher in the public schools than the average Milwaukee parent. So it improved more. The schools improved. Now, when I say this, in two senses. One is the schools literally got better. Two of them were on the verge of bankruptcy. One of them had declared bankruptcy and is now a solid school, Harambe School. It was not going to open until, with the exception when the voucher legislation was passed, it decided to open. Another school was very close to being bankrupt and was in a terrible mess. And it's my great story, and that's Bruce Guadalupe School, a Hispanic school on the south side. When we did a case study of it, and I actually have spent a great deal of time in these schools and many of the Milwaukee schools as well. I've observed 400 classrooms or so in the last 10 years. So I do quantitative research, but I'm in the schools, I think, considerably more than some of the other people that research these issues. And when I did a case study of Bruce Guadalupe in the spring, March of 1991, it was in a terrible mess. It was in a building that was outrageous, and the building was being ripped apart by kids that were out of control. They had been through their third principal in the year, and by March, they were in trouble. It was taken under the wing of the United Community Center, a very important and powerful community center, Hispanic Community Center. They built a new building, and it had 11 classrooms. It opened up 2 years ago, and they have now added another 8 classrooms. They have one of the most lovely buildings you'll ever see. I guarantee you send your kids there, okay? And that's in 5 years. That would not have happened. It's not all because of choice. It's not all because of choice. The leadership there, they raised $1.5 million in the community. They raised $1.7 million from HUD, a federal agency to build a private school. Squirrel that away. Very smart, savvy people can do that. It's very hard to do that. And it's a wonderful thing. Teachers also improved. The teaching, no question. Turnover was reduced. Diversity of teaching took improved and are looking at the teaching in the classroom also showed improvement. On the negative side, what are the negative things? Well, there's three real things that come up. One is attrition from these schools. That's very important. A third of these kids who started the program, left the private schools when they did not have to. In other words, they left before they reached their terminal grade at the school. Now, that has declined over time. Over the full 4 years, it declined, but it still was substantial. I didn't interpret it as negatively as it sounds, but it has a problem, because if in fact you think that private schools are magic schools, and some of you do, I suggest that you really get out there and look at the range of private schools, first of all. And secondly, if they can't hold kids, how are they going to work their magic? So if those kids aren't there, it's going to be pretty hard to do it. Now, is it high or low? It's probably about the same as the mobility within the Milwaukee public school system for that age cohort, which was kindergarten through eighth grade. And that's partly to do with this fact that families move around the city. They move around the city, but they don't always get back to the private school unless there's a way to get them back there. In Milwaukee, a lot of them left because they had moved their location and they were closer to a public school. Some of them left for dissatisfaction. Achievement test scores, the big issue that's contested. My findings stay firm to what I've been saying for 5 years. There's no real difference, consistent difference between the public school kids on achievement gains, these are value-added estimation models, econometric models, and the choice kids. There are gains if you compare the choice kids to the rejected group. And this is the group of kids who applied to the choice program and were rejected. In fact, there's this wonderful study that you may have read about in all the big newspapers, that if you stay for 4 years in the choice program, you go up, and there's a 10 to 12 point increase in that. I found that. What's the 10 to 12 point increase all about? I replicated it. We've been following these reject kids all along. These are the kids who applied and were randomly selected out of the program. They're a very good control group because they control for that selection bias. They should have all the characteristics of the people who apply, but they didn't get the program. Well, it turns out most of those kids didn't go back to MPS and dropped out of the program. 52% didn't go back. They went to another place, and we never have any data on it, but we do know from surveys that they filled out and from prior data that they were higher income, higher educated families, higher kids did better in the schools. So what happens is the rejected group that went back to Milwaukee that they tracked for 4 years, at the end of 4 years, this whole difference is based on 27 kids, only 27 kids in the reject. Those kids are low from the first year all the way across. If I had a graph here, I could show you. The choice kids and the MPS kids are up here on math, right together, going back and forth. And the reject kids from the beginning, from the first time, back in MPS now, these are the same students, the students in MPS, they're way down here. Why? Because there was a counter selection when they didn't get in the choice program back in the MPS. The other reject kids left. They went to the Chapter 220 program in Milwaukee, they went to private schools, or they left the district. Okay. There's one other glitch about this. There are 27 kids there, but I also found out that there's no finding on reading. It's only on math. Now, anybody who's studied test scores knows that there's a high correlation between reading and math, particularly at the elementary level. You can't read the question, you can't do the math, right? Okay, there's high correlation. How high? 60%, 70% correlation, 0.6, 0.7. So when I find a big jump in math and not in reading, I think there's something wrong. 27 kids, five of those kids, I just aggregated. Five of those kids got one on the Iowa Test of Basic Skills. That is the lowest score you can get. The lowest score you can get. Previously, in the previous year, their prior tests averaged 30 percentile. How do you get one? You don't know. You guess, and if you guess, you do better. Happens in inner cities, I'm afraid to say, in Milwaukee. They signed their name to the test, they didn't fill out it. We were almost certain they didn't fill out the questions at all. It's the only way you get that kind of difference. We can't tell because we don't have the individual items. When you throw those five kids out, no matter for what reason they are, let's say it's just five kids, you throw them out, that test score, that 10-point score, goes away completely statistically. There's no statistical significance to the difference. Five kids. The other thing is, look, you got to think about this realistically. A jump of 10 points is a half a standard deviation difference. If you took a half a standard deviation in public and private schools from kindergarten through the 12th grade, you'd have seven standard deviation differences between public and private schools. Does anybody believe that who has studied public and private school differences? It's just, it was out of sight. Now, the one person who was responsible is C.C. Rouse at Princeton University, who's a better econometrician than I am. She has relented on the reject side. She's just making a comparison. We're fighting about the MPS control. She gets a point more than I get, about a point more than I get on the MPS control choice comparison. But that's a minor point. One other negative thing It's not a minor point, it's an interesting point, but it's in the range. We're talking about 1 point differences, 2 point differences in a year. That's reasonable for education production functions, 10 point differences. Whenever you see anything like that, there's something wrong. There's something wrong. I'll just guarantee you, somebody's cooking the test, somebody's doing something that won't last. It's too big. One other thing that's negative, and this is the counter to the positive side of the schools. Four of the schools out of 18 closed their doors during the 4 year period that we were studying these schools. But one of them went bankrupt in the first year. It was a terrible school, one Universal Academy, and had 80 choice kids and about 130 kids. And it was the obverse of all the wonderful schools that I saw. It was just terrible. I won't go into the details. We never did get into do a case study because it closed its doors first. But it was awful. The other school, one of them closed, was a Waldorf school. It didn't close because of the instruction. It closed because Waldorf schools are tough to keep open for reasons that are aside. I don't think that was a question of the differences between parents and administration and the type of education and the controversies over it and the size of it. So that was really on the side. I wouldn't say that had anything to do with choice, really. But then there were two other schools that went bankrupt in 1995, 96, and both of those, the principals of both of those schools were indicted. One of them was not found guilty, one of them was in prison. 356 kids were in those two schools. What does that tell you? It tells you that what you should understand about inner city schools that's different than suburban type schools. It's not in Milwaukee that all the schools are terrible, this snake pit of schools that everybody talks about. That's not right in Milwaukee public schools. What you've got in Milwaukee, as in most other inner cities, is greater variance than you have in the suburbs. In the suburbs, you've got consistently, uniformly pretty good schools. Maybe not all up there in the 90th percentile, but certainly in the 70th percentile. In the inner cities and in the rural areas, poor rural areas, you've got a division. And a large, you've got some good schools over here. You certainly have the mean has moved over to the lower end. And then you've got some terrible schools, and clearly more terrible schools than you have in the suburbs. But you have this wider range. That's what these private schools reflected. They had some terrible ones, and they had some good ones. Bob Adams had an excellent one that almost died. He saved the school. He personally saved it. And then now the choice program, I think, is helping it. But I think that range is a realistic appraisal. Now, to end here, where do I end up? At this point, I think that what I've said are more or less facts, and you can read those as you want. And they're gone in detail in the book that's coming out in November. But that doesn't tell you where you come down on choice. Because where you come down on choice doesn't just depend on facts. It depends on values. It depends on your reading of intentions. It depends on your reading of the future. And there, I have to say, I testified in 1995 against expanding the program to religious schools. I stand on that. I am adamantly opposed to universal voucher programs for the following reason. I am still in favor, and I have been in favor, and testified and written in favor of targeted voucher programs. But I'm leery about them now. I'm leery about the Cleveland one. I'm certainly leery about Milwaukee. Why? Because I think there's a slippery slope. I think politically in the long term it's going to be very difficult to maintain the targeting nature of the voucher program. I think that taking off the income limits, taking off the randomization requirements of a voucher program, taking off the geographic targeting is likely to happen. Mayor John Nordquist, who's white in Milwaukee, one of my old students, I might add, he recently has supported taking off all the income limits in the voucher program in Milwaukee. No income limits at all, but he can't think, said, okay, let's make it $115,000. Okay? I think politically within the state of Wisconsin, it's going to be very hard. I think Tommy Thompson has the power to hold the line, and I think he's going to. But once Tommy retires, if he ever does, it'll be difficult to hold that line. And many people who are very well-meaning people don't think we should keep the limits on. But why would I suggest now that if you don't keep the limits on, I wouldn't like the program? The reason is that in the long and the short term, I think the benefits of a universal voucher program are going to, number one, harm the notion of universal education in the United States. But in the short term, I don't think they're going to benefit poor black people at all. I think they're going to benefit who goes to private schools right now in this country and who goes to private schools in the city of Milwaukee. And I happen to know who that is because I looked at the census data on who goes to public and private schools in the city of Milwaukee. Now, this is 1990 data, but the data is hard and confirmed, and nobody's challenged this. The public schools in 1990, 33% of the public schools were white. Public school children were white. In the city of Milwaukee, 84% of the private schools' kids were white in Milwaukee. Average income, public schools, $25,000. Average income, private school families, $42,500.
Now, you open that up, and who do you think is going to benefit from that? Right now, by the way, we don't know. Because what's happened when, in 1995, when they changed the legislation, they also took out the evaluation paragraph. When they took out the evaluation paragraph, they also took out all the administrative rules that we wrote that included even the knowing the race of the child who's getting the voucher. We do not now know anything about the children getting vouchers in the state of, in the city of Milwaukee. Not one thing. We don't know income, we don't know race, we don't know age, we don't know anything. And we won't unless they change the rules. So right now we don't know if they're white kids or black kids getting vouchers. We knew it very clearly for the first 4 years of that program, first 5 years of that program. Now we don't know anything. Finally, in the long term. Why am I worried about the long term? This is the question that I ask in the Chavez today, but I think you have to think about going toward a fully privatized system. If you people really believe in markets and you really believe in competition the way everybody says, then you got to face this question. It's not that far from a full-fledged voucher program. What will happen if you had privatization of education in America at the K-12 level? I have no doubt in my mind that you would have a more elite system. I have never seen schools that would not want to select if they don't have to. I come from one of the great public universities in this country. And for the size of our state, for the income level of our state, we way overspend on it, okay? We select, and every year, my faculty wants to tighten up and give more requirements to get into the program so we get better and better students, okay? My God, if we're doing it, what do you think Yale and Harvard are doing, for God's sake? They're letting in middle-class kids, but they're only letting in middle-class kids who've got SATs at 1,300, 1,400, 1,500. Of course they're going to select. It goes all the way down. So you're going to have a more elite system if you make it a private system. You're also going to have a more elite system because money's going to matter more. It matters more now. So it's going to matter even more if you don't have government subsidies. Now, why would that be bad? Well, two things. One is I think right now our system over-educates people. I think we put in more money into education, and more education is given to people than probably other nations or the places that we deserve, certainly in an economic sense. If we took away the public subsidy for education, you would reduce the consumption of education considerably. There's no question about that. Is that good or bad? People differ. My gut reaction is it's our future. Over-investing in education with what's happening in the world today, how can you? I spent last year in Europe, a lot of the time in Eastern Europe. They are so envious of the fact that we can support this level of education, that we can send 40% of our kids to a college. They don't all get through, certainly, but we send 40%. The British send 8%. Now, that's got to give us a long-term advantage. I can't prove that to you, but my gut tells me that. And if you pull the plug on public funding of education, in other words, funding it across the community and across generations, that's the way we amortize education, okay? People across the community pay if they have kids or not. Once your kids are gone, you continue to pay, right? You pull that, you're going to have less education. And you're going to have more elite education. Everything in my bones tell me that both those two things are wrong.
Turn to Brother Bob.
Most of you probably remember back in the early 70s when former Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali, was the world heavyweight champion of the world. He was so fast and so good that many people started calling him Superman. There was a time when he was flying somewhere, and as the plane was getting ready to take off, stewardess came down the aisle and said, "Mr. Clay, would you please fasten your seatbelt?" He very indignantly looked up at her and said, "Superman don't wear no seatbelt." Without missing a beat, she looked down at him and said, "Superman don't need no airplane either." My word for you today, as you look at educational reform, choice, and charters, is fasten your seatbelt, because we're getting ready to take off. Now, John did an excellent job as a professor of giving you statistical information, of awing you with some other things, and he's been all over the country and all over the world. But as I was sitting there, I was getting sick because the argument is so schizophrenic about what choice is about, what has happened, and why it's happened. See, John gave you the number of $4,950 that the private schools are getting in Milwaukee. as a part of the voucher. What he forgot to tell you was that if the cost of education of that school is lower, then the amount is lower. But if a high school, as an example, has a cost of education higher than $49.50, they still get $49.50. But beyond all that, what he didn't tell you is the public schools get $9,000 for the same child. See, the schizophrenia here is that the Milwaukee Press and MPS and WEAC and the NEA and the ACLU and the People for the Separation of Church and State said the public schools are going to lose $22 million this year with choice. They're going to take all of that valuable resource. Well, we studied. We studied it from 1990 to 1999, the years of the program. We found out that NPS spending increased by 29% in that period. Its enrollment only grew by 8%. State aid grew by 55%, and Milwaukee Public Schools taxes decreased by 33%. What they forgot to tell you was all those kids that left the public schools, the rest of the portion of that $9,000 stayed with the public school. So this cry about we need smaller classes, you got them. You got fewer kids, more money. Now how do you lose? I don't get it. I think many of you remember in Dante's Inferno, that sign that says, the hottest places in hell are reserved for those who remain silent in times of moral crises. Now I'm a simple man. I don't have time to deal with a lot of statistical information. I haven't written a book, have no intention of doing it, but I know this. If I'm looking at a school system that has 100,000 kids, most of them poor, most of them minority, and they have less than 50% who graduate, and of that number, the average grade is a D plus, and when we break it down racially, for every one black male that graduates, 10 drop out, that's a crisis. And everybody keeps saying, give us more money and smaller classes. But we can go around the corner to a school that has the same demographic makeup and graduate 90% and above of the students, 85% go on to college and do it for almost half the amount of money. Why not? And the fear that somehow when religious schools came in this year, that they were going to proselytize and try to convert all these people, what they forgot to tell you was that the legislature put in what's called an opt-out clause in Milwaukee, which means any child or their parent that comes to a religious school can simply say, I don't want to pray, I don't want to go to mass, I don't want to go on retreat, and there's nothing we can do about it. To date, not one child in the city that I know of has exercised that right. What they also forgot to tell you, and I don't know. Sometimes I look at this whole thing and I really wonder what is going on. Because I'm looking at kids and I'm saying that this really is not about kids. Because if it were, why would we stop parents from exercising the very freedom that most of us exercise every day? I mean, what's so unique about a parent or a guardian saying, I want my child to go to that school? And if your school is so good, why are you afraid to compete with my school? I mean, the choice here is just that. But, you know, people, and this is the thing I was just going to say, they forgot to tell you, we don't have a choice in who we take. This argument that we've skimmed off the cream of the crop and all we're getting are the bright kids, it's not true. These are the poorest of the poor, and the first ones that walk up to our door, we take. I just did a survey. We run a high school and an elementary school, fifth grade. We tested everybody with Iowa Basics in September. So let's just say over the summer, a kid lost a couple months. So for a kid going into fifth grade, he or she should be 5'5"1. The average was 2.6, the grade equivalent. That's the average. Now, that's not the worst problem. The worst problem is when you look at those kids' report cards and they're getting A's, B's, and C's. Somebody did something wrong. And that's the problem. The future and what's going to happen in Milwaukee is very simple. The argument that choice in charters would not change, they lied. Chubb and Moe told you it would happen before them. Coleman told you it would happen. It has happened. Mysteriously, in the last few years in Milwaukee, every public school has a sign that says, high standards begin here. We want to talk about elitism. There are five schools in Milwaukee for years that had admission standards that nobody knew about. And guess what happened last year? Everybody else wants to have admission standards. Let's start looking at attendance and test scores and parental involvement. And we don't have any problem with that. Just don't throw it out as something bad that the private schools are doing. Choice and charters have changed education in Milwaukee, and make no mistake, they've changed education in this country. There is nowhere virtually that you can go where you can't talk about education without talking about these two. And if you want to know how serious it is, you will find that list of the usual suspects at every gathering. They've poured a lot of money into it. They've set up offices all over the country, and this is essentially a battle for the hearts, the souls, and the bodies of children. And for us to sit by and do nothing while 50% drop out of school every year, that's morally wrong. Thank you.
First of all, I want to congratulate this audience on its patience. I have about 12 minutes to explain why most of what you've heard today is irrelevant to policy issues. But if any of you, in view of your long day, finished before I do, I want you to feel free to leave as far as I'm concerned. My presentation is devoted to the distinction between school choice in a competitive education industry and the implications of this distinction. Usually I refrain from quoting any personal experience in a presentation like this, and because my feeling is that if a speaker can't cite non-personal data, there probably isn't very much. But in this case, I hope they'll excuse it, because I'm going to mention a personal experience since it's cited to illustrate, not to prove a point. In 1962, I was a candidate for the presidency of the American Federation of Teachers. And at the time, the AFT had two caucuses, very evenly divided, that tried to elect their slates to the AFT offices. The incumbent president, Carl Nagel, was a candidate of the Classroom Teacher Caucus. And I was a member of the Progressive Caucus and sought its nomination for the presidency. The caucus vote to choose the nominee was held late Tuesday evening after a debate and a question and answer period. I won the caucus nomination by about 40 votes out of a total of 750. I went to bed shortly thereafter, anticipating an intensive morning of campaigning. The election was held on the Wednesday afternoon following the nominations. Before going to bed, my campaign manager recommended that we have stickers printed proclaiming that I like Mike. Inasmuch as several all-night printing companies in Detroit could print the stickers in time, I approved the recommendation before going to bed. About 6 a.m. on Wednesday, I woke up to good and bad news. The good news was that the stickers had been printed and distributed to the rooms of the delegates. The bad news was that they had been printed by a non-union shop, hence did not carry the union label. And so during the early morning hours, my supporters and I went through the convention hotels in a futile effort to retrieve the stickers. The incident was not the, by no means the only reason that I lost. I got a third of the convention votes, by the way, which was pretty good under the circumstances. But it was very costly in several ways. Now, the lesson I learned from this was simple enough. Others may share your goals. They may be fine persons dedicated to your success in every way. They may have given unstintingly of themselves without thought of personal gain to achieve your shared objectives. They may admire you, even think you can walk on water. And yet, despite all of the above, they may do things that are irretrievable harmful to the goals that you share. This incident comes to mind as I think about the supporters of school choice at this conference. No doubt some favor a competitive education industry. No doubt most, if not all, are fine people who would gladly sacrifice to achieve that goal. Although I don't know any who think that I walk on water, a few have complimented my efforts to achieve what they assume to be our common objectives. Nevertheless, I believe that most of the supporters of school choice at this conference are supporting arguments and practical activity that are a disservice to the objective of a competitive education industry. I don't suggest that all of their activities have this effect or their net impact is negative, although I believe this to be the case more often than they might assume. In the few minutes that remain on Friday afternoon, I'm not going to try to review everybody's presentation to explain the basis of my criticism. Instead, I shall limit myself to a few examples based not only on what the speakers have said here, but on what they have repeatedly said elsewhere to national audiences. First, however, let me offer one observation. School choice is a vague phrase, and its popularity among conservatives is partly attributable to its vagueness. It came into vogue to meet the need for a term to replace vouchers, a term that carries significant baggage politically in the wars over school choice. For example, very interesting in the California and the campaign over Proposition 174 in 1993. The union ran in their polling, showed that support dropped a very significant number of points if it had the word vouchers instead of parental choice. And they got the Secretary of State to change the title of voucher instead of being parental choice to voucher, and the support for it dropped overnight by a considerable margin. Now, a significant philosophical inconsistency over the concept of freedom has emerged in these battles. Typically, contemporary liberals have argued that freedom is the power to do something. And inasmuch as the power to do something often requires funding, the liberals support government funding, for example, of abortions. They say the legal right to have an abortion, they're trying to stop that too, but or they're trying to promote that, but they're saying if you don't have the power, the right doesn't mean anything. Now, the other concept of freedom is that it consists of the absence of government restraint. You are free to have an abortion or send your child to a private school as long as the government does not prohibit such action. Consequently, in abortion controversies, the pro-choice groups are the ones who support government funding of abortions, and the anti-choice groups are the ones who oppose it. In the school controversies, their position is reversed. The same groups that argue for government funding in the abortion context also argue against government funding of choice in the school context and vice versa. Now, a favorite punchline among conservative supporters of school choice, and we've heard that just an hour or so ago, Bill and Hillary Clinton are the only occupants of public housing who could send their child to an expensive private school. Shouldn't the poor parents in the inner cities have the same right, they ask, assuming that the only answer is yes? Well, from a legal point of view, they have the right. What they lack is not the right, they lack the money. Now, do we say we're gonna fund everybody in this context? That's liberal dogma, not conservative dogma. Of course, there is the option of defining freedom or rights in terms of the power to do something. But such an approach leads inexorably to the welfare state and all the government subsidies that the conservatives supposedly abhor. Now, I don't believe enough attention has been paid to the inconsistencies in both the liberal and conservative positions. And my only point here is that school choice, or that choice, is a buzzword that interest groups try to adapt for their own objectives. Now, the vagueness of school choice is evident when we consider the various plans to which the label is applied. These plans, whether in operation or only envisaged, differ in virtually every conceivable way. Who is eligible, the amount of the voucher, whether it's called a voucher or a scholarship, the grade levels, the regulations, how they can change the duration of the plan, you name it, they differ on all these criteria. The critical point, however, is that none of these plans, operational or envisaged, come remotely close to constituting a competitive education industry. A competitive education industry would be one in which no producer or consumer controls output or prices. No barriers to entry to the market, meaning that for-profit entities are free to compete. Inefficient producers must improve or face extinction, and prices inform producers and consumers of what's happening in the market. Unfortunately, since the media, the public, and the politicians do not distinguish a competitive education industry from other versions of school choice, the negatives associated with these other versions will inevitably be attributed to a competitive education industry. Regrettably, this is already happening, and I predict it will happen on a much bigger scale in the future. Now, most emphatically, I'm not opposed to the school choice plans that do not constitute a competitive education industry. What I am opposed to is the idea that such projects, such as Milwaukee and Cleveland, can tell us very much, if anything, about what would happen under a competitive education industry. And I am therefore opposed to treating these projects as tests of, or even relevant to, the desirability of a competitive education industry. School supporters exacerbate the problem by referring to school choice programs as, quote, experiments, unquote. If these programs are experiments, what hypotheses are being tested? I didn't hear one today, and I was here all day. I may have dozed off, I'll be 80 next month, but I didn't hear anybody propose a hypothesis. Now, if you have a hypothesis, you're supposed to state the conditions very carefully, so that people know if you're testing a drug, you've got to know all the conditions. We didn't hear any of that, really. So if you don't know the hypothesis and know all the conditions of the experiment, what basis do we have for concluding that the experiment has succeeded or failed, or that another experiment will test the same hypothesis? In all of the choice programs that have been discussed at this conference, I had yet to encounter one that had a clearly stated hypothesis or statement of the relevant conditions. Now, when you label something an experiment, the implication is that you're testing something meaningful. In this case, the common perception is that school choice is being tested. Consequently, if the, quote, experiment is not a success, the public can hardly be criticized for concluding that school choice is not a good idea. And if this perception grows, as it will, when everything labeled school choice is embraced as a quote experiment or pilot project, no matter how limiting the conditions, it will be more difficult to generate public support for a competitive education industry. The opponents of a competitive education industry have been very successful in confining public and professional attention on achievement outcomes. Very little attention is being paid to the cost side of the issue, and I congratulate Brother Bob for making a point of that. The one-sided focus on achievement is going to boomerang on the supporters of school choice. An analogy will help to explain why. Suppose you are asked to choose between two cars that are identical in every respect but two. Car A gets 25 miles to the gallon and costs $10,000. Car B gets 26 miles to the gallon and costs $100,000. Which car do you choose to buy? Well, I think most, if not all of us, would choose A, even though it provides an inferior level of service. B, superior level of service is purchased at an exorbitant cost. Similarly, in view of the much higher level of per pupil expenditures in public schools, their pupils will sometimes show superior outcomes. If and when this happens, it will no more demonstrate the superiority of public schools over a competitive education industry than Car B, then Car B is a superior option in the example. Almost through. It is legitimate to assert that there is a school choice movement in the United States and to regard every expansion of choice as evidence of it. In doing so, however, it should be recognized that some of these expansions of choice will not result in improvement or affect either the outcome or the cost side. In any case, it is critically important that the idea of a competitive education industry not be tied intellectually or politically to the outcomes of other school choice programs. Now, the criticisms of what I'm saying are that it's unrealistic, that it overlooks the necessity of an incremental approach, and so forth and so on. And although there isn't time to discuss these, let me conclude by giving my reaction to that criticism. In 1962, Milton Friedman published Capitalism and Freedom, the book which set forth the case for a competitive education industry. Coincidentally, 1962 was the year in which the first collective bargaining agreement in public education was negotiated between a teacher union and a board of education. 10 years later, over half the nation's teachers were covered by union contracts. Today, about 70% or more. With the possible exception of changes resulting from racial issues, this has been the most fundamental change in K-12 education in the latter half of the 20th century. As a true believer who was present at the creation, I can say that its supporters did not think incrementally or point to successful examples of collective bargaining. There weren't any. Meanwhile, 37 years later, today, we do not have a competitive K-12 education market anywhere in the United States. Although the public policy case for it is overwhelmingly stronger than the case for public sector bargaining was or is. In my view, I've heard all about the great progress that's being made in the school choice movement. But I doubt whether it is progress toward a competitive education industry. In the past year alone, the California Teachers Association has added 37,000 members, an increase of over $20 million in revenues going to the most implacable opponents of school choice, or let alone a competitive education industry. Evidence such as this suggests to me that absent a critical assessment of strategy and tactics, it may be a long time indeed for a competitive education industry to emerge in the United States.
Well, it's 6 o'clock, so I actually want to take a couple questions. questions.
Okay, we have time for a couple of questions.
Ask Brother Bob, if it happened that in some religious schools, a lot of people started exercising this opt-out thing, how do you think, how would you react to that? I guess, how should people who care about the religious mission of religious schools react to that?
That's an excellent question. And one of the things that we said at Mesmer was that there were some non-negotiables of our involvement and choice, and one was our Catholicity. Most of our kids are non-Catholic, but the root of our success is in being able to talk about God and to pray and to teach religion. And so if we had a high number of students and families that exercised it, then we would have to look very seriously as to whether or not we'd participate. And any school that chooses not to, as many of the Lutheran schools in Milwaukee have said, because of the opt-out, we're not going to participate.
I just wanted to know how Woody reacts to what he would have to say about the graduation rates. Obviously, graduation
rates. I look at dropout rates forever. They're the hardest things to understand and to study. A lot of times, like the thing was cited in the public, in the thing, 46% of the kids who started at the Cleveland schools. A lot of those statistics are computed in the following way: they take the freshman class. They look through and then they take a look at the senior year and they say who's graduating from that freshman class and who's still there, going to be in there in the fifth year. Okay, and then the kids that are in, that are not there, they consider dropouts. That's a ridiculous way to look at it. That many of these 40 and 50 and 60% dropout rates that are talked about, they're hard to substantiate, and they're also extremely hard to substantiate with another figure that again is based on census data and based on better numbers altogether, and that is that our graduation rate based on census data is about 77% graduating from high school and has remained that. It has stalled. It has stalled considerably. The other thing that's unknown about that, by the way, since 1950s, if you control for income, the black attainment rate and graduation rate in the United States is higher than the white attainment rate if you control for income. It has been since the late 1950s. Okay? So I think that when you hear about graduation rates, you've got to look very carefully at what they are. They don't jive with the other things. In Milwaukee, I tried desperately in 1984 to 85, the public schools, to come up with a dropout rate. The best I could do was a dropout rate between, I think it was 23% and 29% over a five-year period. That was a five-year dropout rate, including 5 years. And we couldn't get any closer to that. They lost track of 5,000 kids. So it's very hard to look at. The other thing I wanted to say, one other thing, because I got to leave, on the money side, it's true that they spend a lot of money, but there's a study by Hank Levin and Cyrus Driver that looked very carefully at the comparison between the Milwaukee public school costs at the elementary level or the K-8 level, which is what the private schools were, and what the MPS was spending at the K-8 level, subtracting out the things the private schools weren't doing, like exceptional education. And they came up flat at best, spending the same amount as the private schools in the year 1994. So you got to be very careful about these numbers. You can't just throw in the average number or say a high school number compared to an elementary number. The differences are extraordinary in how much you spend at those two levels. And you can't also compare it when you've got, you know how expensive exceptional education is. It's three times the cost on average of a non-exceptional education kid in the United States. So if you've got one school that's not dealing with exceptional education kids and one that isn't, I mean, they've really got apples and oranges kind of problem. So this, I think that Levin and Driver actually overstate the case. I think the private schools still spend less than the public schools in Milwaukee do. Now, the time I studied them, they spent considerably less. And that's why the point that Myron's making, that the achievement scores that were the same in the public and the private, I never interpreted those negatively. I put right in the reports that they are doing it with considerably less resources. I estimated the differences at about 68%. Because that's about what the differences in salary costs were, salary and benefit costs. I think that was it might have been a little bit lower than that. Maybe 65% was the private school to public school ratio at that time. One of the things that's happened in Milwaukee because of the vouchers and the increasing is those salaries have gone up in the private school. I mean, they were $12,000 was a starting salary in the private schools. And the people that they had to take the teaching job were either dedicated women, primarily, almost exclusively women, who had extra, who had spouses that made money on the outside, often suburban women. They were dedicated people, often who had come through the system. They graduated from urban day school and they wanted to go back. And they were willing to take the rap. Or they were young college kids right out of school, couldn't get a job in the public sector. They took a job, and I interviewed three in a row that said, I have to live with my mother. I don't want to live with my mother. I'm 22 years old, but I can't afford it. I'm looking for a job. All three of them were gone. They were excellent teachers. And they were at Harambee School. They all left within 2 years because they couldn't afford to live on it. Now Harambee School can pay more. They can get closer to the towns. I have to go. Thank you.
I think we should carry on the discussion. We have a very nice reception for everyone over at the Radisson Hotel next door on the second floor in the atrium. So I said, I guess we all retire to the Radisson and carry on the conversation from there. Thank you all very much for coming.